Welcome back, everyone. We are Simply Bitcoin. We break down the news from Twitter, the Daily Fail, meme review, software releases, hardware releases, and the websites by plebs. Joining us today, very special guest, Dr. Ron Paul, not the American politician, different Dr. Ron Paul, and he's quoted in The Economist, Forbes, Politico, Reuters, and elsewhere, including academic research papers and U.S. Senate testimony describing the modern anti-money laundering experiment. Yes, that sounds amazing, but first, we're going to the numbers. That's right.
Number time!
Number Time is brought to you by Bitcoin 2022. It's going to be the largest Bitcoin conference ever. Get your tickets fast before the price goes up in 6 days and take advantage of the link down below for 10% off your tickets to Bitcoin 2022.
At the time of this recording, the block height is 712,144. The Bitcoin price, 57,140. Chain rewrite days, 842. Total public Lightning capacity, 3,302.85. That's right. We are holding steady. Sats per dollar or Moscow time, 1750, and blocks to the halving, 127,856.
I have a question for Dr. Ron, Phil. I have a question.
Yeah.
Because he told us that he's just getting his feet wet in the Bitcoin space. Dr. Ron, when you see the Bitcoin price, you know, as an observer, right? Because Phil and I are in the flux, you know, so obviously, you know, we're very biased and we see it. But from an outsider's perspective, you're looking at the Bitcoin price today. What are your thoughts about it? What are your feelings? Do you think it's too expensive? Are you kind of, you know, awestruck? What are your thoughts about it?
Not at all, really. To me, it's, I mean, I've got an economics background as well, I suppose. So to me, it's just a number. So, you know, it used to be, you know, less than a dollar, you know, 10 cents or so, and it's been up to 64,000, maybe it'll be a million. It's kind of irrelevant what the number actually is. It just is what it is. And for me, it's, is it useful? Does it serve a purpose? And the price is in that sense, largely irrelevant.
That is super refreshing, because what we've usually noticed, especially people, perhaps because you in your line of study, but we kind of have a joke on Bitcoin Twitter, which is if you have a PhD in economics, you don't understand Bitcoin, because it's really a PhD in economic and Keynesian economics, right?
Yeah, so, very cool.
So
and,
I mean,
in fact, my degree in economics is merely a bachelor's degree, and it was a bachelor's degree back in the day when there wasn't even behavioral economics, and I wish there was, because to me that's the most exciting area, really. And so I went to psychology lectures, and instead, the psychology lecturer said, "Well, I didn't see you at the exam." I said, "Well, I'm not enrolled in your class. I'm just here for fun." So I'm with you on that.
So your mind wasn't corrupted by the Keynesians.
No. Well, I was also lucky, because I was doing a law degree at the same time as my economics degree. So I think if I was doing one or the other, I would have been corrupted by either of them, because they're both, you know, somewhat mad in some respects, both areas. But doing both together meant that, you know, my brain had to jump around quite a lot, and that made it interesting.
Awesome. So when you see what's going on right now, and specifically in the U.S., because I want to focus the news segment on specifically on the KYC amount, I think the numbers is perfect for this. When you see the situation with the money printing all around the world, I know you were telling us before we started recording specifically about, you know, the central bankers in the United States. What are your feelings about it? Because you have to understand, Phil and I see it from a Bitcoiner's perspective, right? We see it through the eyes of Bitcoiners. We don't see it through the eyes of anybody else. So as someone who's just dipping their toes in the space, what are your thoughts on the historical amount of money printing happening on a worldwide scale?
Well, it's quite astonishing, really, and I think quite concerning. There's two narratives. Well, there's quite a few, but there's two main narratives in a sense. A lot of people think that, you know, Jerome Powell has saved the economy by this, but actually there's quite a few others that that think that this is creating a massive bubble in a whole lot of areas, including, of course, Bitcoin, but in property and certainly in the S&P 500, etc. And the amount of money printing is potentially going to be massively destructive and even catastrophic for the for the US dollar, but also the impact globally is huge, and that flows onto every asset class. So obviously Bitcoin is one of those asset classes, but everything else. And you know, I find that quite disturbing that there is. It was since 2007, 2008 when this really, really started, and it's never stopped. And since last year, it's gone into hyperdrive, and so the impact of that is, you know, we still don't know what that impact is going to be, but it's not looking pretty in terms of where it's going to potentially end up.
Absolutely, Phil.
Do you think? Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you think that we sound crazy when we think that, and it's okay if you do, when we think that essentially these types of events, right, that have been occurring, especially in the last, you know, in the last 2 years, not even just that, right, even the 2008 mortgage crisis, these manufactured bubbles and busts, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, are we crazy that we think that that essentially they're manufactured just to hide the money printing that they can't stop doing anymore?
Well, and again, this is not my specialty area as such, but
that's okay.
Looking at it, and I've got an economics, a dusty old economics degree.
It's more than I've got.
but I don't call myself an economist, but at all. So I look at it in a sort of from a generally broadly educated sort of a perspective. So you know, I'm not claiming to be right as such, but I think there's a lot to be said for allowing the economy to have a few ups and downs as it goes along, rather than trying to prevent that happening. And by preventing it, actually it's making it much, 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 much worse. The bubble we're in now, it's been called the everything bubble. It, you know, when that bursts, and I say when because it always reverts to mean, and it's been wildly above it for a long time. I can't predict when it's going to happen, but it always reverts to mean. That's the only lesson that we can look at from history. It is just going to be horrible for so many people. And so, you know, my traditional approach to this is, you know, why not just allow the economy to tick along, ups and downs, etc., and to iron out the worst of it, perhaps, but not try and the massive control that's since 2008, and particularly since 2020, that's happening. So that's, you know, different people have different views on that. That's just, you know, where I come at it from, and you know, I'm deeply concerned about where it's going to go.
Absolutely. You sound like an Austrian economist, to be honest. And you know what, Doctor? It's incredibly refreshing to hear your perspective, because Phil and I are just like, are we in an echo chamber? Are we seeing this?
Because we are. You know?
Yeah, we are in an echo chamber, but it's incredibly refreshing to hear, you know, someone mm-hmm. from outside the industry essentially making the same connections that Phil and I have been making for a year, because it's incredibly hard on us, Doctor, because we cover mainstream media or legacy media. They're not really mainstream anymore, but legacy media, because it's our job to do so. But if you were to just listen and take their reporting at face value, you would have had this inflation would have caught you completely off guard. And it can't be that two small YouTubers have been telling everyone inflation was coming since January, and we were right, and all of the legacy media machine was completely wrong. So it makes you wonder, it's like, are these people so caught up in their Keynesian economics, or are they straight up lying to people to cover exactly what it is they're doing?
Yeah, you know, a number of different ways. The straight economist approach would say that inflation is actually, you know, the money supply increase, it's not the increase in prices, but that's a bit too technical, I suppose. But also a big part of that is that there's been a massive increase in money supply, but the velocity of money hadn't increased much. That's why inflation wasn't, in the sense of prices going up, wasn't so much. But a whole lot of that, that equation is changing, plus, of course, the supply issues, which people are talking about. And, you know, I don't know if we'll end up in a hyper inflation situation or not. Some people are suggesting that. Don't know the answer to that. But certainly it's pretty significant. And the Fed is in a very, very difficult position at the moment of its own creation, I believe. You know, does it address inflation as it's saying it's going to do, or does it not do so and continue what it's been doing? It's not a good result either way.
Yeah, they either crash the economy if they taper off, or, you know, they keep printing money and that causes inflation. But I'm so glad that we're seeing eye to eye. You know, that's incredibly refreshing. We've kind of been underwater for 6 months. Like, Phil, are we doing this right? So it's incredibly, you know, refreshing to hear from someone of your stature. And man, oh, awesome. But anyways, Phil, it's time for
The Daily Fail. The Daily Fail is brought to you by Amber App. Check them out. Amber.app. Bitcoin made easy. It's the easiest way to buy Bitcoin. Stack sats with Amber App. The link is down below. Okay, so Nico made a good point. He said that Yellow is a spokes Muppet.
No!
I'm gonna agree. He's not a spokes person, but he's a spokes Muppet.
Malaka.
What do you think?
Amber. The smart way to stack sats.
That's right. Cleaned up my browser. Still haven't updated it yet because I have 36 windows open. But tonight it gets updated, so no more red. No more red up there, and that's right. I got rid of the meta crap. Okay. So, because that's not actually being used. Oh, that was brutal. Anyways, shout out to Fractal Encrypt. I know, I apologize to our guest. He does not know what happened yesterday, but Fractal Encrypt, the amazing Bitcoiner that he is, totally called me out on a shitcoin program that I had installed on my computer a long time ago that was still sitting there. Anyways. Yes. Okay, let's dive into this, right? We're going right into it. Crypto scammers make $9 million on fake YouTube streams. Guys, I see these all the time. Let's dive into it. We can riff on this for a bit. Crypto scammers during the month of October got around $9 million by defrauding their victims through fake giveaway scams on YouTube. Tenable revealed that scammers tend to use old, irrelevant, and unrelated YouTube interviews videos featuring popular individuals in the shitcoin industry like Elon Musk, Vitalik Buterin, Michael Saylor, who's not a shitcoiner, he's a Bitcoiner, okay? But anyways, they always group crypto all together, and crypto doesn't exist. There's Bitcoin and shitcoins. Apologies. Anyways, and others while accompanying the videos with tweets detailing a fake giveaway event. It continued that the scammers usually have a dedicated section in the video comment section where they promise to double the number of crypto donations sent by the viewers to their desired crypto wallet address. Fraudsters got over $8 million from Bitcoin-related scams, while they got $413,000 from giveaway scams on the second largest crypto asset by market cap, Ethereum. It also revealed that the scammers profited from the growing popularity of the meme coin Shiba Inu, as they were also able to defraud people of around $240,000. Okay. So look, I don't know if you guys see these videos too often, okay? But usually it'll show an interview, right? Like they were explaining, it's exactly what it is. I report at least anywhere from 3 to 5 videos like that a day, okay? And it's really sickening because, let's be honest, right? Didn't Pomp end up having an issue with YouTube? Didn't they take his channel down, if I'm not mistaken? Okay,
well,
so there's
a lot of, man, Keep It Simple Bitcoin. They took his channel.
Keep It Simple Bitcoin too, right? And he's just offering how-to stuff. So again, right? So we're seeing actual channels with signal, okay, getting taken down, but yet the crypto scammers, they roam free. I mean, this is daily stuff, and it's really scary. So please, just, you know, I know that most of the people listening to this are, you know, fellow plebs, and they already know this. But just, if you're a noob, no one is just going to give you free Bitcoin. Okay, like, no one is just, like, you're not just going to send Bitcoin and they're going to give you double the amount of Bitcoin. That's not how math works. Okay, that's not how any of this works, right? I wouldn't give you double the amount of Bitcoin because you sent me a certain amount. Like, I wouldn't do that. Why? There's no incentive. Okay, so don't live in fantasy land.
I think, you know, it's unfortunate they prey on noobs in the beginning, you know, people that are just getting into the industry and they see Michael Saylor and they see these established figureheads and they automatically think, oh, this must be legit. But that's how complex the scam is, right? They get video, old videos, then they come up with the header to make you think that it's, you know, it's Pomp, it's Saylor, it's Vitalik actually behind those videos, but in reality it's scammers. But the part that I want to focus on, Phil, and you kind of riffed on this a little bit, is the fact that YouTube is focusing on shutting down actual channels that are not scams, right? Rather than going after the you know, I'm sure they shut those down eventually, but they go on for hours, Phil, right?
Don't get me wrong, you're talking like 4 hour, 10 hour, 12 hour streams, and it's constant.
Yep.
It's insane.
So let's move on to the next fail.
Next fail?
We can go to the big review. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, next fail. This is some juicy stuff, guys. All right, I'm giving a shout out to Iceosonaut. Tagged me in this. Quinn and Chris, this makes me proud. What's he talking about? BBC News reported this. Token Estate blocks JRR token cryptocurrency.
They were going to ruin Lord of the Rings?
They were going to ruin Lord of the Rings with a shitcoin. Very clever, okay? And I'm going to add a shitcoining token story of my own where I tried to shitcoin Lord of the Rings once in my life. But not real shitcoin, but a shitcoin type of move, as you'll see. Anyways. Okay, so...
That photo is in New Zealand.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's little, the Hobbit little,
which
town.
One?
The Hobbit town.
It's a little town out of Manamata. That was filmed in New Zealand. That's where I
am
right
awesome.
Now. I'm just up the road from that town.
Cool. You know what? I'm a huge fan of Lord of the Rings in real life. I think it's an absolutely amazing story. It has, you know, all the great themes, right? The, you know, light and darkness and all the fantastic themes that tug at all of our heartstrings. And I love it. Okay, so here we go. Let's dive into these shenanigans. Token Estate blocks JRR token cryptocurrency. Lawyers representing the estate... Hold on, let me start again. I feel like the window's not big enough. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Lawyers representing the estate said the product launched in August infringing the author's trademark. Website selling and promoting the cryptocurrency JRRToken.com and the Token of Power featured rings, hobbit holes, and wizard like Gandalf. The US-based developer paid the estate's legal costs, which the lawyer said were significant. The estate filed a complaint with the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, one day after tokens for the cryptocurrency JRR went on sale, aiming to organize the people towards a common goal of making JRR token the one token that rules them all. Yeah, I know. This is corny AF. All right. And the domain name JRRToken.com registered in February 2021, right? So you could see they figured that out real quick, was specifically designed to mislead people into believing it had a legitimate commercial connection with the author. The developer said, the fact that the disputed domain name brings to mind the complaints, trademarks, is indicative of the parody evoked by the JRR token, not of any purported bad faith. Really? And JRR stood for, check this out, Journey Through Risk to Reward, a reference to a unique form of digital currency. So the JRR had nothing to do, so the fact that they had the wizards and the same look... That was all just different, right? The name was really this. Yeah, Journey Through Risk to Reward. Oh, okay. But the WIPO dismissed this, saying it's not clear to the panel that Journey Through Risk to Reward actually means and why the term journey is relevant to the purchase of tokens. The respondent does not specify why the disputed domain name is humorous, funny, or nail-biting, and not just a domain name chosen due to its similarities with the token estate's trademarks, to take commercial advantage of its evocation. And there was no doubt that the developer was aware of Token's works and had created a website to trade off of the fame of these works. All right. So look, that last piece, right? So, JRR Token's books have been around for a very long time. A very long time. Like, when I was 12 years old and 11 years old, those books were already old. Okay? So, just to give you an idea, right? And my shitcoin story goes like this. So, not realizing, right, that in grade 6, my teacher would read this book every single year. I didn't know this. So, I decided that I would write a book report on that book. But you see, I didn't actually read the book. I read the front piece, right? With like the little intro. And then I read the back of the book. And then I wrote my report. And then I stood there in front of the class and I essentially read what I had plagiarized. And my teacher, who was very nice at the time, had pointed out that she reads this book to her class every year. So... That's BS. What this developer is saying that he had never heard of tokens work, like, don't bullshit a bullshitter, bud. Okay, like, I got busted for
you
this.
You dishonored the doc.
Okay. I did. I totally did. Right? And like, I learned a very valuable lesson at a young age, right? Which is proof of work. Do the work.
Okay. That's a good lesson. That's a good lesson. So, I mean, dude, does it surprise me that shitcoiners took a great piece of literature and they tried to profit off it? Not at all. Doc, do you have any closing thoughts on this madness?
I don't think I can add anything to it, really.
Man, awesome fails, Phil. But anyways, it's time for the Daily Meme Reviews. The Daily Meme Review is sponsored by Citadel 21. It's the best Bitcoin cultural zine, different artwork every volume, and it's scarce. There's only 1,000 copies per volume. Really cool stuff. Get your copy of Citadel 21 today. All right, everybody, the first meme for today is brought to us by Elon Musk, and this is the new CEO of Twitter, and this is a famous picture of Stalin, and he just... You know, they didn't even have Photoshop back then, but he photoshopped the person out, and it's the new CEO of Twitter, and he photoshopped Jack Dorsey. And these are the original. Let me see if I could find the original pictures to kind of give you guys some reference. This is the original picture of Stalin and him just taking it out. And he actually himself was executed. So he executed it. And I think it's a really reminiscence of the times. Anyways, next meme. It's not really a meme, but it's a very powerful image, and I picked this one because the doc was coming today. In 1964, the minimum wage was five 90% silver quarters. In 2021, five 90% silver quarters have a melt value of $23.34. We don't need minimum wages. We need sound money. I think that's insane, right? That the actual the monetary value of the money remains. But as they debased it, just the money became worthless. Absolutely fascinating. Last but not least, this is meme by DJ B. Footbridges. Natural progression. It's primitive, the shells, the gold, you know, the beginning of paper money and where we are today, proof of work, and it's Bitcoin. So awesome memes. Really, really cool stuff. Phil, for that, I'm going to give it one half-eaten plantain chip. What about you?
That is an awesome score. Yeah, excuse me. That is an awesome score. I am going to get... So, love the memes. I thought they were great. And I totally love that meme with the money. Fantastic. Really well illustrated. Sells a whole history of money all in one picture. Memes. Very important. And on that note, I am going to give it this travel mic. That's right. It's for an iPhone.
Does it work?
Yes. It's a very good mic. It's awesome.
That's really cool. What about
you?
Yeah,
it's a
Dr. Paul, what would you give those memes?
It's a good book. It's a good book. It's a classic.
So I feel like you've read it. You looked at it as if you read it.
Yeah, the blunders of government? No, I'm shaking my head because I'm like added to my wish list. that sounds like something everybody should be reading.
I think every new parliamentarian should read that. That's actually a UK-based book, but any country could produce a similar book that looks at a whole lot of things that governments have done that were plainly flawed years later, massive cost, massive expense, etc. And it just goes on. It carries on. We've got a few dozen in the last year, just in the US. Another few dozen in the UK. So you could write a book like that every year, sadly.
What's the really famous saying where it's like, you mess up in government, you get promoted. You mess up in private business, you go out of business. You know, it's the only I would say institution, corporation, whatever. I don't know what you want to describe it as, that rewards failure. Right. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's a really good point. But anyways, Phil, it's time for the Daily News. The Daily News is brought to you by CryptoCloaks.com. Get yourself the best 3D printed Bitcoin merch, like the 3D printed Bitcoin grenade art. Really cool stuff. You can unravel it and you can put an open dime in there. Or the 3D printed Bitcoin honey badge. You could also put your favorite hardware wallet. Really cool stuff. Take advantage of the link down below for 5% off CryptoCloaks.com. All right, everybody. So check out this article. SEC Chairman Gary Gensler, Bitcoin competes with the U.S. banking system. And we brought a very special guest to talk about the AML, the KYC, all of that stuff. But anyways, I'm going to tie it in a second. Bitcoin is a competitor to the U.S. banking system and its worldwide consensus, the Security Exchange Commissioner Chairman Gary Gensler said on Wednesday, "We layered our digital money system about 40 years ago with money laundering and various sanctions and regimes around the world. We layered that over a digital currency system called our banking system," Gensler said. In 2008, Satoshi Nakamoto wrote this paper in part as a reaction, an off-the-grid type of approach. It's not surprising that there's some competition that you and I don't support, but that's trying to undermine the worldwide consensus. Now, I want to focus on this part where he said 40 years ago with money laundering and various sanctions, right? So the reason I wanted to focus on that is because we brought Dr. Paul today to kind of debunk a lot of the official narrative that, you know, these regulators would like you to believe, because essentially the way that he's posing this is the world would burn down without the current money laundering system. But we covered this many, many months ago. The actual current money laundering system is extremely inefficient and it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And this is a perfect segue to Dr. Paul's paper, Anti-Money Laundering, the World's Least Effective Policy Experiment, Together We Could Fix It. So anyways, the introduction says, a worldwide policy paradigm enforcing complex anti-money laundering laws gives the comfort of activity and feeling of security. And this is exactly what he's referring to when Chairman Gary Gensler says this, right? You know, he's acting as if, you know, the current monetary system is good. If you compare Bitcoin is all inclusive. Bitcoin doesn't care where you're from, what your skin color is, what country you happen to be born in. It's all inclusive. Anybody could download a Bitcoin wallet. The current monetary system, if you happen to be born in Afghanistan, if you happen to be born in Venezuela, you are deemed unbankable by the system. So one is a system of inclusion, the other is a system of exclusion. But anyways, continuing on, letting criminal enterprises retain up to 99.95% of criminal proceeds, the modern anti-money laundering experiment unwittingly enables, protects, and supports terrorists, drug, human, arms, and wildlife traffickers, sex and law labor exploiters and corrupt officials, fraudsters, and tax evaders on a global scale. So it actually does the exact opposite of what it's supposed to do. Anti-money laundering is a globally significant policy function affecting millions of businesses and billions of people daily. So it seems odd that policy design issues are mostly addressed independently. More explicit connections with the rigor of policy science should contribute to better results, right? And here is no success metric, minimal data. Despite trillions of dollars poured into the global 30-year war against money laundering, the anti-money laundering movement remains unable to show policy success. The primary goal was to use money flows to detect and prevent serious crime, and thereby reduce and prevent the economic and social harm caused by serious profit-motivated crime. It is against such outcomes that effectiveness might be best judged. Curiously, no such crime reduction and prevention measures were identified. So, Dr. Ron, I think we have been pitched as a society, what I was saying earlier, that without these measures in place, the world's burned down. I think when they made Bitcoin legal tender in El Salvador, it actually showed the exact opposite of that. Bitcoin actually included more people, right, into the monetary system in a month of being legal tender than the legacy financial system did in 40 years. And the specific numbers is there's 1.8 million bank accounts in El Salvador. There is currently 3.3 million people that have downloaded a Bitcoin wallet in El Salvador. So already more people are using Bitcoin in only 30 days of Bitcoin being legal tender. So Dr. Ron, and I, again, this is a speculation, why are these policies the way they are? If they were supposed to stop money laundering, if they're supposed to stop crime and they're not effective at stopping crime, why do they exist?
Well, I can't talk to the reason why they were put in that space, or why they continue ignoring the evidence. But certainly when it was set up, it was never set up to prevent crime. It was sort of a magical belief that if We comply with these rules that match these standards that should have an impact on crime. Now, from a scientific perspective, that's perfectly legitimate to make that call back in 1990 as they did. It's a testable hypothesis. So, okay, we've created these brand new standards. We believe they're going to have this impact. That's perfectly fine to base something on an assumption. Don't have any problem with that in science. That's the way science works. But the curious thing about it is that come 1991, all of a sudden, banks, and so very few countries had signed up to that new model because it didn't they couldn't demonstrate that it had an impact on crime. And so FATF, the Paris-based outfit that's responsible for these standards, had a choice, essentially. It could have proved that it had an impact on crime, but of course it couldn't do that because it hasn't had that impact even today. But instead, banks started using it as a proxy, use the ratings as a proxy indicator of risk. Whether it was a real indicator of risk or not is irrelevant. And all of a sudden, for countries to get access to the financial system, they actually had to have the FATF tick. So countries signed up, not because it had an impact on crime or not, not because the system actually worked or didn't work, but because they had no choice, because the country needed to, you know, countries needed to have access to the financial system. And so from that moment, FATF never had to prove that it had an impact on crime. And they haven't. And in fact, if you were to ask someone and say, where's the proof that it has an impact on a substantial demonstrable, and I'm talking about a robust, scientifically robust demonstration, an impact on money laundering, impact on serious profit motivated crime, an impact on terrorism, they have never proven it. They don't even collect the data on those matters.
So, and let's talk about what you were talking about. So you're talking about the Financial Action Task Force. This is a bureaucratic, unelected body based in Paris. So if they're not effective on crime, and let me pull up some statistics. So, you know, some stats so that the audience could see from your paper. So in terms of the impact on profit-motivated crime revealed by such studies, Europol says that authorities only confiscated about $1.2 billion of illicit funds annually. This suggests that the proportion of criminal funds recovered, termed the success rate, of anti-money laundering efforts by the UN is just 1.1%, right? So that's minuscule, and that's exactly what you were saying, Doctor. So who is the FATFA? What is their history? Why did they come about? Who they help more? Because if they didn't help anybody, they wouldn't exist, right?
They were set up in 1989. G7 nations decided that they wanted to really attack, use the money flows, which it makes perfect sense, and there's actually legitimate science behind it as well. There's follow the money. It goes right back into Italy and partly in the US, etc. So there is science behind that, the follow the money. So the G7 wanted to stop drugs trafficking at the time. That was the main focus. So they decided to set up this new task force to do that. Unfortunately, the new task force did a whole lot of things based a whole lot of what they were doing on a whole series of assumptions. And they came up with this idea, which is, again, not necessarily a bad idea. It's proven to be a bad idea, but it was reasonable at the time. If we come up with all these standards, and if countries comply with these standards, and if countries put in place regulations that comply with the standards, and if banks comply with those regulations, therefore that should have an impact on crime, was the assumption. That's never been tested. In fact, when scientists have started to test that, and that started to happen about 1994, scientists were able to find that it actually isn't proven to have such an impact. But it continues. For a whole series of reasons, but there's certainly a deep belief. In fact, the AML system is a bit like, you know, how some people from the outside might look at Bitcoin as perhaps there's a deep, deep, deep sense of belief in here. And certainly the AML community is very, very strong on believing that it works. And when scientists point out, fairly uncomfortable truths and suggest, well, actually, you know, let's peel back some of these assumptions, a lot of people really, they seem to take personal offense at it. And they, rather than testing the hypothesis themselves, rather than, you know, engage in that conversation, they just insist that it must be wrong. And that's been going on now for, the better part of 30 years.
So there's like cognitive dissonance when you actually show these individuals that the hard data, you know, the what the actual results of their policies are, they don't understand it. Could it be that their jobs depend on them not understanding it, and that's why they are they react the way they do?
I think the reasons are complex. I think people are complex beings, and there are a lot of people within the industry who have come to realize it, and are asking the questions. So that's actually really positive. There are a great many others who aren't. There are some, as you say, whose job does depend on it. There are a great many others who have been the way that the system is set up, the expertise, the way it's set up. It's a system that inculcates a narrative, and it doesn't test the narrative, and so the whole system is designed to be self-perpetuating, and that is the way it works. And so you've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of compliance professionals, most of whom are incredibly genuine, and they genuinely believe they're having the impact on crime. And indeed, there are specific instances where they are having an impact on some criminal activity, so that reinforces that way of thinking. And very often it's that genuineness of feeling that is actually getting in the way, because they so genuinely believe they're having the impact, and then if you test it, they take that as a personal front rather than let's engage in that conversation and let's see if we can have a greater impact. And often people also say, oh, but we're having some impact, therefore that's a good thing, and then they miss the counterfactual. So if our impact on profit motivated crime, let's say the impact on financial criminal finances is say 0.5% or 1.1%, whatever it happens to be, depending what data you look at. And they say, oh, well, that's a start. That's a good thing. We just need to do a bit more of it. Well, if we do that and we go from 0.05% to 0.1% to 0.2%, but we're missing the fact, if we look at it slightly differently, maybe we can go to 20%. And have a massive impact on crime. And it's not even those percentages themselves are rather pointless. I use those figures, and the United Nations use those figures. They're not actually outcomes either. In terms of outcome science, what we're really looking for is, how do we dramatically reduce the social and economic harms from serious crime? And that's more difficult to quantify and to measure. Mm. We come back and we find the nearest proxy to that. And one of those proxies is what the UN, as you've talked about, the so-called UN success rate. And that's a reasonable proxy. But what's really interesting is that what the industry itself does isn't even close to those proxies. The industry's measures, and they call it effectiveness and outcomes, which bears no relationship to effectiveness and outcome science, unfortunately, is all about activity and outputs. So what it does, it measures what the industry does, not what it achieves. And that's a fundamental failing of the whole system. And it's been that way since the year dot, or 1990.
It almost sounds like they're tailoring the data to kind of fulfill their own needs. And I was reading your paper as well, and lower in the paper, it actually gets even more fascinating. And this kind of bridges what a lot of Bitcoiners have to say about it. You know, maybe it comes from the conspiracy theory front, but I would love to get your opinion, is that a lot of these systems are in place, the way that we see it, it's more so to control people than to stop crime. And this is a fascinating passage from your article. It says, banks are a much easier target for regulators than criminals. If authorities recover around $3 billion per annum from criminals, while us imposing compliance costs of $300 billion and penalizing businesses another $8 billion a year, it is reasonable to ask if the real target of anti-money laundering laws is legitimate enterprises rather than criminal enterprises. So it is. And, I saw that, and I remember, and we were reading this with Phil, and I was shocked. I was like, isn't this the exact opposite of what it's supposed to do? It's supposed to stop criminal activity, but they're actually collecting the most money from legitimate businesses. Isn't it the exact opposite? This sounds like a self-fulfilling bureaucracy, Dr. Paul.
Oh, it is. And I, in my research, I look at it as scientifically as possible, as robustly as possible. So I don't attribute any, what people are thinking or what they're trying to do, etc., to it. I look at the hard evidence and see what we can find from that. Every now and then we do get an interesting little snippet. So some scientists, for example, found that they found some declassified documents, correspondence between US and UK officials in 1987, a few years before these laws came into play. and they only got a 6-month window of declassified documents. They've been declassified for a whole, they've been classified for a long time, and they only got that. But that indicated that US and UK officials were deliberately seeking to undermine, to enable laundering to continue, which was fascinating when you come to it. But my research doesn't depend on, you know, are they doing it for control reasons, etc. Because I look at the data and can't really attribute that sort of thinking to it. But certainly it is consistent with that. And very often one of the barriers is that because people believe that it has an impact, and they genuinely believe they're fighting crime, so that's another possibility. Therefore, when you come up with evidence that that's not the case, they don't engage in that conversation. As you said earlier, there could be cognitive bias taking place there as well. So again, there's no need, from my research at least, to attribute any rationale to it. It's just, I look at the impact and the effect. And so the impact of these laws is far, far greater on legitimate businesses. And in fact, every cent of that cost imposed on legitimate businesses, all the penalties against banks that we all like to cheer because everyone hates banks. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. It just, you know, that's the public that tends to happen. Well, actually, citizens pay every cent of that as taxpayers, as shareholders and as citizens, because, you know, banks pass on every cent of that just in terms of the way the business model works. So we actually pay the massive cost of it. And there's only two global industries that dramatically benefit from the current AML laws, and that's organized crime and organized compliance.
Wow. So Phil, do you have any questions?
You know, I don't know if it's a question or more of an observation. I kind of want to get your take on this, but in just listening to this, right, and listening to the process that, you know, we make corporations go through, essentially this looks to me like they want to create a large enough moat so that there's no competition, and the only people that can come into the game are people that are, you know, already into the, you know, in the club, or friends of friends in the club.
Well, that's actually very, I mean, again, I don't say that's the reason people are doing it, but that's certainly the impact of it. So absolutely, there's a massive market entry barrier here, because the cost of this is so enormous. The Economist pointed out a couple of years ago that major banks have up to 15% of their staff on compliance tasks. Now, that's astonishing. If it's anywhere near that in any large bank. But even if the fascinating thing is, even if you went to 100% compliance, you still couldn't comply, because the laws are actually designed, they're impossible to comply with. I could go into any bank anywhere in the world with a couple of decent analysts, and I will find breaches of anti-money laundering laws, no question. That's just the way it operates. So you could always find compliance breaches, but a great many of these breaches have nothing to do with, there's no money laundering involved, there's no crime involved. They just happen to not tick the boxes that they're told to tick. Does ticking those boxes have an impact on money laundering? Does it have an impact on crime? Does it have an impact on terrorism? Oh, we don't ask that question. And so we're penalizing these banks for all of these things, and that massive, massive cost on those banks. The big banks can wear it. Some have gone bust, but some of them, most of them can wear it. And then you've got a new startup that wants to come into the business, and they've got to put this massive cost structure in place. And it's really hard. So yes, it chills competition enormously.
You're making me think of the, you know, as you're explaining that, I'm totally going to butcher this, but it's like the broken window. It's like the broken window theory, right? Where it's like they, and the other thing is the other point too, that it also makes me think of is that it makes me think of the story of the, you know, the bed of Procrustes, right? Where, Nico, we've discussed this before, right? Where essentially the KYC AML, they're essentially, you know, trying to, you know, kind of Frankenstein this system onto Bitcoin. I don't mean to, but just to bring it over to Bitcoin, like they're trying to Frankenstein it onto Bitcoin, and it's already not working effectively, as, you know, as is actually proved in the current system. And I think it's even less effective to, you know, essentially to Bitcoin.
Well, there's simplistic narratives. It's sort of the simplistic narrative that AML, you know, anti-money laundering, stops crime and must be applied uncritically to Bitcoin and other crypto, etc. But that's not actually the case. And so it's fascinating too. So when Bitcoiners engage in the conversation about what regulation should look like, they're fighting the you know, crypto is bad and it allows criminals to do their things. And so they address those issues, and that's fair enough. That does need to be addressed, and you're explaining to senators how it actually works, etc. And some have come on board and some are against it, and you have that conversation. But the real Trojan horse, seems to me, is the bit that most Bitcoiners aren't aware of at all, because they take on board the narrative that AML is designed to stop crime, and we all want to stop crime, so okay, we can accept that as a possibility, let's do that. The trouble is the AML system, even in fiat, does not have the impact that it is claimed. And so that's the, you can explain why crypto is okay and everyone, it's not used that much by criminals anymore. And in fact, fiat's used a lot more by criminals. You can explain all of that sort of stuff to senators. You can get them on board. But even so, once the AML thing is on board, in the crypto space, it's not necessarily going to be particularly effective if it's screamingly ineffective in the fiat space, and has been since day one. We're now over three decades of profound ineffectiveness.
So, Doctor, you said earlier that it helps organized crime. Could you elaborate a little bit? Like, how does the current system, the current AML KYC system, help organize crime? Because you would think it would have the exact opposite effect.
No, absolutely. A couple of different ways of looking at it. One, big picture. So certainly AML and KYC does actually have an impact on crime. It does stop some criminals, right? So that's why some people say, oh, therefore it works. But you're kind of missing the point. So let's say that we're having a 0.1% impact on criminal finances, which is a proxy towards the impact. And it doesn't really matter whether it's 0.1%, 0.2%, which is what the UN said a while ago, or the latest one, which is my 1.05%. It's de minimis, right? So doing more and more of what we doing more and more compliance, more and more regulations, which is the standard response. So we get to 0.2%, we get to 0.4%, whatever. We're still having almost zero impact on crime. And so crims are getting, they get to keep 99.95% of proceeds, minus their cost, etc. Now, that's why it works really, really well. While we are focused on this, on sweating that 0.1%, rather than thinking, it's not working quite so well, rather than focus on sweating that, I mean, yes, that's good, we're getting a few criminals, let's stand back a bit and how can we actually reframe it and refocus it so we're actually hitting 20%, 30%, whatever it is. When we're at that level, which is a profound impact, and my modeling shows that it's a massive reduction in cost, massive reduction in compliance, massive reduction in regulations to get a massive increase in impact on crime. But when we're at that level, that's when we're actually starting to have an impact on crime. So when a crim is thinking, do I set up my next sex trafficking ring, which has been so successful so far, there's going to be a huge likelihood I'm going to get caught. Maybe I won't do that one. That's a little simplistic, obviously, but so at that broader perspective, it helps criminals because we are so focused on sweating that 0.1%, they just carry on with their business. Thank you very much. At a specific level, and this is another thing too, a lot of people in the industry think that KYC identification, etc., that's the nirvana. And so a lot of businesses are set up, okay, I'm going to check your ID. Once I've checked your ID, tick, I'm helping stop crime. But people like me think, well, it's empirical research. So what's the reality? What actually happens? So me and various other researchers have looked at what criminals actually do, and I have found. So, for example, in the housing industry, I have found that in real estate transactions, very often criminals loved when they were asked for ID, because in the past they were skulking in the background. They had all this cash, from their drugs dealing, etc., and it was quite difficult. Now they look like a property developer. You know, actually, KYC often helps. And I've got one of my blog posts points out some of this as well. KYC often helps criminals launder proceeds of crime and make them look legitimate. It's fantastic. Thank you very much. So at the big picture level and the smaller picture level, you know, I suggested in one of my articles, not an academic research paper, but a slightly more mainstream one, that, you know, if we were to ask a criminal mastermind to rewrite the AML laws, she would say, "No, you're doing fine. Keep going the way you're doing it. That's good."
That's absolutely fascinating, and it actually makes sense when you think about it, because criminals think it's like, if I'm compliant, they'll leave me alone. So I just have to figure out how to be compliant, and I'm in the clear. My money's in the clear. So,
I can add a little bit more to that. I was talking to a senior banker in the US a little while back, and he was saying to me that actually, as long as criminals keep doing what they're doing, we'll never spot them. And the reason for that is because we've set up our systems the way that they all set up systems. We need to follow this. It's rules and scenarios that they focus on. These are rules. These are things we know criminals do. Therefore, you banks must have these rules and scenarios to look for the criminals and along these particular lines, right? And so they look for anomalies outside those things. And so if a criminal does something different, they might get spotted. So this chap was saying, as long as criminals keep doing what they've always been doing, we'll never see them. And this is a major, major US bank. And, you know, I've seen that in real life too. And it's also fascinating, the lawmaking process. And I pointed that in another blog post. AML has distorted the way laws are created. Ordinarily, you look at what's the problem? How do we fix it? Let's craft a law that does that. And you know, it's pretty rough sausage making process, the lawmaking process, but that's broadly what it is. AML is different. AML is we have to put in place these laws that match these standards. So countries put in place laws that match those standards on the assumption it's going to have that impact. So again, I did some empirical research which identified exactly how criminals launder proceeds of crime in a particular jurisdiction. That country introduced laws, you know, AML laws. They were utterly uninterested in the research that demonstrated how criminals actually did it. And certainly the applying the FATF standards would have some impact in terms of some of that criminal activity that I identified. There's a lot of that criminal activity that the laws would have no impact at all on. And so the only people who knew that was me, who, you know, having done the empirical research, and the crims. Whereas the lawmakers believed that it would have the impact. And even when they knew that empirical evidence existed, how crims actually launder proceeds of crime, they were uninterested because, no, this will fix it. And so crims just carry on. It's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man, this is absolutely mind-blowing, Phil.
I just wanted to quickly say this is so interesting because it sounds just like what happens in the corporate world, right? You end up managing to the metric. So the criminals simply just say, oh, okay, this is the list I need to check in order to manage to this metric so I can move to the next step.
Yeah.
And then they just produce the data.
It's even worse than that. It's even worse than that in a number of ways, because the system is set up so that banks will do these things that we know that crims do, right? Now, that's maybe 1% of what actually crims do, right? So the 99% of crims are fine anyway, right, irrespective of that, because the system isn't set up to find crime. The system is set up to tick these particular boxes. Then on that, and I'm just making this figure up in terms of the 1%, the empirical research shows it's broadly somewhere there, but whatever. So on that 1%, crims have to tick those boxes, as you say. But of course, all those boxes are well known in public, so the crims can study that in advance before they even become law, and so ensure that they, you know, tick those boxes nicely. Often, or sometimes, I can't say often because I don't know how often it is. But certainly, in my research, we find that crims actively go out of their way to tick some of those boxes that that expose them in a sense, because that enables them to do the laundering they're wanting to do, and allows them to, in the case I mentioned, to be seen as property developers rather than drug dealers, which is apparently, you know, better in society. So it's quite remarkable when you look at it in an empirical basis, but the policymakers don't look at it from an empirical basis. They look at it from it's also quite funny because they look at researchers and say, "Oh, you're dealing with theory. We deal with practice." Well, in this case, it's the exact opposite, because they're dealing with a theory that the assumption that if everyone follows these rules, following these standards, and everyone complies, therefore it should have an impact. That's by definition, that's an assumption, right? And so whereas researchers look at empirical evidence, how does it actually work? And we drill right down, we peel away all those assumptions and see what actually happens in real life. And very often we find that, the Crims are very, very happy indeed, thank you very much. It's very, very simple to launder vast sums of money to your heart's content. And one extra level, it's not even a matter of tick boxes, because the boxes that we're asked to tick themselves don't actually focus on whether there's an impact on crime or terrorism or even money laundering. So the system that's set up to be anti-money laundering doesn't actually have any metrics to identify if it has an impact on money laundering. Let alone crime and terrorism.
I think that's the smoking gun, you know, because it clearly, you know, and it's unfortunate because I think we've been conditioned in a way into thinking these systems are necessary. And, you know, it was just until this year, and it was only because I'm into Bitcoin and because these regulations are starting to have an effect on our industry. We know that Janet Yellen, you know, the U.S. Secretary, you know, you hear the rhetoric. You hear the rhetoric from Jerome Powell. You know, Bitcoin is only used for illicit purposes. It's is used to skip, you know, anti-money laundering regulation. But when you actually look at the data, and Chain Analysis actually came out with some figures, it was a small percentage of the total Bitcoin transactions are connected to illicit activities, and a much higher percentage is actually connected to fiat. But they don't say that, right? It's like they want you to believe a certain narrative, but once you peel back the onion, so to speak, I know, Dr. Paul, you don't like to speculate, you like to be data and evidence based. But at the same time, you come to the conclusion they're really doing this for control. I if it's not for stopping crime, if more companies are if companies are spending more on the compliance costs than they actually are on getting back money from crime, what is this but not control? And again, of course, that's speculation. But from the eyes of a Bitcoiner, that's what we see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's certainly, you know, that may well actually be a driver of some people. So, for example, the U.S. government is a good example. The U.S. Treasury, you mentioned right at the outset, is focused on sanctions, etc. Now, it has been said by some, and it's very, very difficult to prove because you've got to be in the meetings. And I do have some anecdotal evidence, but it's only anecdotal, so I don't put it any higher than that. But there are certainly some say that because the US has such a disproportionate control over FATF, so FATF has only got 38 members, and those members essentially rule 205 countries and jurisdictions around the world. You must follow these rules. But in fact, in reality, it's not those 38 members. So smaller countries like New Zealand and Australia, who are FATF members, don't have the power of the US and the UK and a few others. There's only a few countries that really drive inside FATF, and there's some researchers that have really focused in on that and how FATF operates. And so the US has got its normal sanctions approach because it's the US dollar is the reserve currency. But also, if a number of researchers are suggesting, and then they're getting quite close to demonstrating it, but it's hard to prove, that the US might not really care where the money laundering laws work at all, because it's another form of sanction. And it's a form of sanction that appears to be objective and appears to be done by this other agency, although the US is heavily controlling it. Now, there's layers of that too. So, for example, the FBI and a few other agencies would disagree with that because they are genuinely focused on trying to stop crime. But then you look at and you look in Treasury and you split parts of Treasury up. There'll be some of those in there who are really, really focused on crime as well. But there are others who think, yeah, well, this is really quite a nice measure. We're able to get another sanction out there. So so it's nuanced. And again, my research isn't particularly concerned about what the rationale is, because I haven't been able to get into that to identify the rationale. That involves interviewing all those people and testing that, which I've not done. But certainly the figures, real, you know, it is so profoundly ineffective that you do have to ask the question, what is the rationale? And the rationale could be, as you say, control. We don't care if it works or not. We just want control. Or the rationale could be there is a deep narrative that people believe it. Therefore, they're not going to ask that question. No, it is true because I believe it's true. Therefore, it's true. And so they believe they're having the impact on crime and they're not going to have that other conversation. So it could span any of those elements. So again, I don't want to attribute one to the other, but it's certainly consistent with what you say as well.
It sounds like it was born out of good intentions, and then there is a bureaucracy built around it. A lot of people's jobs depend on this narrative. And then, you know, hey, why not? You know, we have all this information. You know, the government's not going to say no to it. So I think, and then over time, it's just solidified. And now it's just become an expectation. It's, if you can't have these things, the world's going to burn down. I think that's where we find our situation in today. But absolutely phenomenal conversation. Extremely interesting. But anyways, Phil, it's time for, there's a software release today. Why don't you tell everybody about it?
Software releases. Software releases is brought to you by CypherSafe. Check them out, cyphersafe.io. Get your hands on a Cypher wheel. This is the best way to store your Bitcoin seed. Fireproof, waterproof, pet proof. The link is down below. All right, we've got Seed Signer version 0.4.5 that was released. It is down below in the show notes.
Awesome. Thank you, Phil. All right, guys, that was our show. Before we go, I want to give a very, very special shout out. We are deeply humbled to have Dr. Ron Paul on the show. He was quoted in The Economist, Forbes, Politico, Reuters, and he has done a testimony in the U.S. Senate describing the modern anti-money laundering experiment, and really, really cool stuff. Definitely support Dr. Ron. We're going to put his Bitcoin address down below. He's doing the research, and I'm sure we're going to use a lot of this research as Bitcoin and these antiquated, ineffective regulations inevitably clash within the next 5 years. I'm sure Dr. Ron Paul is going to be, we're going to use his work, and perhaps we're going to use his testimony. So definitely support Dr. Ron. Use the Bitcoin address down below. Donate a little bit, guys. We have to give back for the much smarter, educated people that have all the fancy degrees, because Phil and I are just are just Bitcoiners, YouTube Bitcoiners. But anyways, guys, if you enjoyed the show, you know what to do. Smash that like button. And of course, if you want to continue hearing the Bitcoin news from the pleb perspective and the catastrophic fails, definitely consider subscribing to Simply Bitcoin. And we'll see you tomorrow, guys, for a brand new episode.
Maybe KYC AML's use case was to validate crime all along.